Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
I hit the ball first time, and there it was in the back of the net.
Motivation, yes. Motivation, the 3 M's.
That's perverse. In a football field, with kids watching.
Ladies and gentlemen, England will be playing 4-4-2.
Take a penalty.
8-1.
8-1.
I'm just saying to the colleague, referee's got me the sack. Thank you ever so much for that one.
Hello and welcome to Beyond the Touchline. We are back and we have an absolute doozy of an episode for you that will contain both swearing and ranting. Joining me is Seb Patrick. Seb, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you.
Yeah. Good, good, good. My name's David Hartrick and we'll get cracked on because we've got a lot of ground to cover. We are a podcast, so we have to start with an opening question or I believe we get kicked off podcast platforms. Quite simply, what is your favourite slash best example of a footballer appearing on film, Seb?
We talked about it a little bit when we did the Goal TV episode because it featured in the clip showing that. But I find it really hard to look past Graeme Souness and to a lesser extent Sammy Lee in Boys from the Black Stuff.
You're Graeme Souness, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're famous.
Well,
I'm Yossi Hughes.
Pleased to meet you.
You look like me.
Oh, aye.
Magnum as well.
Pardon?
Magnum. A detective. He used to be on the television. An American.
Oh, aye.
For those who haven't seen it, it's a scene where Yossi Hughes, the famous Yossi Hughes, played by Bernard Hill, gate crashes a charity party in order to meet Graeme Souness because he looks like him. Has this conversation with him where, you know, he says, "You're Graeme Souness, you look like me, Magnum as well." and because he does look like him. And there's multiple reasons why it works. I mean, to be honest, most of them aren't Graeme Souness. The reasons why it works are because it's an Alan Bleasdale drama and it's Bernard Hill, and Bernard Hill's performance as Yossi Hughes is just one of the greatest performances in British television drama. But this scene is like, it feels a bit like a kind of a proto Begbie in that it's dripping with this tension of sort of, is he, and his kids are there in the scene as well, but he's like, is he gonna kind of go a little bit nuts here? Because he's just, you know, throughout the whole thing he's a man on the verge of cracking. But it's just great, and like, he has this weird conversation about how he looks like him. He asks him for his autograph, and there's a great bit where he says, he's already said that his name's Yozza, and then he says, "Will you sign this, Graham?" Graham's like, "Who's it to?" He goes, "Me." "Oh, what name is it?" "Yossi Hughes." And then so he signs it. He's like, "Oh, lovely, thanks, Graham." And it's like, Graeme Souness himself Doesn't have to do very much. It's very restrained, but actually he's very good at doing the little that he has to do, which is to be very reticent and a bit bewildered. But again, underneath the surface is, here is an extremely hard Scottish man who, if you start on him, will probably lay you out. And in the meantime, you've got Sammy Lee sitting in the background being completely ignored and just sitting there looking terrified throughout the whole scene. Sammy Lee doesn't say a word, but is just terrified throughout the whole scene. It's great. I mean, if anyone hasn't seen Boys from the Black Stuff, and in particular the Yozza Story episode, because they're actually all, they've got a running thread, but they are all actually kind of self-contained individual dramas, go and hunt it down, or at the very least watch that scene, because it's hilarious.
I can't agree enough, really. I'm slightly obsessed with footballers in adverts, particularly when they have to act to any sort of degree. I did an England-based Twitter account with Mr. Football Clichés, Adam Hurry, and one of the best threads we did was tracking down various England ex and current footballers in adverts from all around the world. David Beckham's acting, long before King Arthur, was already very, very dodgy. If I say the words outside, then there'll be a lot of people who remember that particular Pepsi ad with zero fondness. But my favourite instance of footballers on screen is actually Football Managers, and it's a Yellow Pages advert, and it's Bobby Robson and Graham Taylor who ring each other, and they're having a chat, and they sort out a cake to welcome Terry Venables into the England job.
Wow.
Clara's Cakes.
Hello, I wonder if you can help me.
Yes, we could do that. Fine. What colour would you like the tracksuit? Orange?
Do I not like orange?
Pardon?
It's just a joke, love. Blue, I think. I see here it says you deliver.
Oh, that's nice. Good luck from Bobby and Graham.
And it is one of the reasons I love it is it's because, so, you know, football is so serious now, you couldn't possibly do it. And it's just a really lovely little, you know, 35 seconds of football on screen, really. Taylor and Robson, their sort of acting is limited, but they both do it really, really well, like genuinely well as well. You know, there's a genuine level of affection there. And then Terry Venables, when he gets the cake at the end, pulls it off. You know, he's you would expect him to, though, because he is a bit Mr. Showbiz, Terry Venables, at the best of times.
The cake at the end that they've sent him is a lion wearing a Union Jack flag with Terry, well, a man in a tracksuit with Tell written on the back, putting his head into the lion's mouth.
Yeah, and it says so much about football at the time. But as I said, it's just it's sort of so gentle, and it's just lovely. And it's,
there's something very nice. I mean, let's face it. Like Graham Taylor is like one of the best people to have worked in football, as is Bobby Robson. In fact, the both of them are. But Taylor in particular, like to be in 1994 to do an advert, like that's not that long after everything.
Yeah.
And you know, the way that he was treated, and to do that advert with a smile on his face reflects really well on him, I think.
Well, this is it. I like Bobby Robson's treatment from sort of 1988 to 1990 in the England job was just I mean, when you think of headlines like "In the name of Allah, please go," stuff you just wouldn't get away with now. And then Graham Taylor came into the job, and the problem was the papers had just had the best part of 4 years learning and understanding that negativity towards England sold them vast numbers of papers and helped them win these mad circulation wars. Graham Taylor just walked into an absolute bear pit. You know, genuinely, it's no exaggeration to say he never had a hope in hell, Graham Taylor. He could have won the World Cup and they would still have torn him apart. But to do an advert like that, and just as I said, to sort of poke fun at the situation, I just love it. Absolutely love it. I win this week because there's only two of us and I get to decide. So that's out. There you go.
All right. I will leave you to tell Yozza Hughes and Graeme Souness that they haven't won.
Fine. Right. We'll get into our main discussion, which is we're going to talk about a film that several people remember with fondness. Lots of people have seen at least part of it. Everybody remembers the ending. It is one of those films for football fans. It is 1996's When Saturday Comes, starring, you bastard, Sean Bean.
If you could have been a footballer, you'd have been snapped up by England schoolboys 2 years ago.
You cheeky little git. I don't need to go down to the careers office to know how you'll end up.
Morning, Judd.
Morning, Jimmy.
What time of day do you call this?
What? I'm 9 minutes late.
Who's that, bull neck?
You can forget about getting your leg over with a...
She'll come out with it.
Well, I don't know if my husband would be too happy about that.
You're married?
No, I was only joking.
She'll come out with me then?
Bruno tells me you're an expert footballer. I'd love to see you play sometime.
Ken Jackson, coach for Allen Football Club. We're looking for a good right winger.
Another brilliant performance there tonight, laddie.
He was here tonight, huh? Ooh. Tony Cully. Wants to give you a trial.
Jimmy, it's your trial tomorrow. You want to make it a quiet night?
Good point, T.
Thank you, fine.
Have seven large whiskies, please.
Where the bloody hell have you been?
You smell like a brewery. You're out, son.
You couldn't have caught it or better if you'd have tried.
Is this what you want? Strippers and boozers, huh?
You're sorry. You're selfish. But potential's no bloody good if you haven't got the courage to do something with it.
Want it back, kid?
I know you do that.
You better not blow it.
He won't blow it.
Is he game tomorrow?
Seems to let you play.
Now, before we get into the sort of nitty gritty and the fine detail, Seb, I would like to I'm gonna read out the IMDb description of the story, okay? And then I just want to have a few minutes as not spoilers per se, but I think what I want to do is just. Give me your thoughts on it overall, and then I'm going to give you my thoughts on it overall. Because I think when people listen to this, there's going to be a few people who've not seen it for a long time, and as I said, have probably a level of fondness for it that I don't think is deserved. But we shall get on to that. So, in terms of the plot, Jimmy Muir is a hard-drinking brewery worker in the city of Sheffield with an arrogant lack of respect for authority. His entire life has been orientated by football and he possesses the potential but has never had the courage or discipline to make anything of it. Jimmy is spotted by Ken Jackson whilst playing for his pub team. Is it a pub team or is it Hallam FC, are we supposed
no,
to?
No, he joins Hallam after being spotted
yes,
playing
yeah,
for his
that's it, yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So Ken is the manager of Hallam Football Club, of course, a local non-league team. After continually playing brilliantly for Hallam, Jimmy gets offered a trial at Sheffield United at the age of about 35, but we'll get there. I'm simmering here, Seb. I really want to get into tearing this apart. The evening before the trial, he gets drunk and wakes up feeling very rough. Consequently, he fails to impress the Sheffield United manager. Jimmy then has to consider his future and his choices and if he has the self-discipline to succeed. Now, that doesn't really cover everywhere the film goes. But, yeah, give me a minute on did you even like this film, Seb?
The answer to whether I liked the film is a very straightforward one, which is no, I did not. But I think it's worth separating out, as I think we will generally do with football films on this podcast, which is to look at them how they are as football films, and specifically by that, I don't even really mean like how they are thematically about football or that kind of thing. I really just mean how they portray football on the screen, and then how they are as films. And we'll get into it a bit more. I think that in terms of how it portrays football on the screen, while there are niggles over the circumstances that it shows, when it's actually showing people kicking balls around, I do think it's one of the better examples. That is about the only compliment I'm going to pay the film, though, because as a film, it is absolutely wretched. It is poorly written, poorly directed, and dreadfully acted melodrama that is cliched, predictable, and it's unpleasant. I think that's the main thing about it. There is nothing or nobody, not even Pete Postlethwaite. Of all people, you'd think you could root for Pete Postlethwaite, but he doesn't have enough to do in the film to warrant it. There is nobody to root for in this film. There is nothing that you care about. Everyone in it is just horrible. And I mean, well, no, there's one character who could be likable if they weren't played by somebody doing one of the worst accent performances in the history of cinema. It's just a bad film. I'm not saying I can't like or enjoy a bad film. And in the way that there are people who are like, who are fans of this and obviously have affection for it, I would probably liken it to something like, and just to go off on a bit of a tangent, Driven, the IndyCar film with Sylvester Stallone and Burt Reynolds from 2000, which was going to be a Formula One film, and then it ended up getting turned into an IndyCar film. It's a terrible film on just about every conceivable level, but I kind of have quite a lot of affection for it. And I can only imagine that the people who like this film feel like that, because if they actually think it's a good film, I shudder to think what they think a bad one is.
Driven is the one where he drives round and flicks the quarters out and picks them up on the, in
oh,
the
yes.
soft tires, isn't it?
Yes.
And he takes one of the cars out on the road at one point.
They have a car chase through the streets of Chicago stealing experimental cars that are being demonstrated at an event, and one of them drives off angrily, and then Sylvester Stallone, the young character played by Kit Pardue, and Sylvester Stallone drives off after him. When I first saw that film, that was on the TV, that was the first scene that I saw, and I thought, this is the most ridiculous and awful film I've ever seen. And then I watched it all the way through and I was like, this is still the most ridiculous and awful film I've ever seen, but I kind of love it anyway.
Yeah, well, that was Get Carter remake era Stallone, and he quietly produced quite a number of semi-enjoyable films, which brings me to talk about my feelings towards this film. I won't use this word very often when we are doing this podcast, because there's very little. It just feels like it's a fairly terrible emotion to put out there, and I hate listening to podcasts where everything is overtly negative. But I think this film is hateful. I really do. I going back and watching it, I remember, I wouldn't say I had fond memories of it, but I had memories of it. You know, I remember watching it and knowing it was objectively a bad film, but it was a football film, and as a football fan, this was the football film of the 90s. But watching it now, it is, I mean, you're exactly right, Seb. For a start, nobody in it is likable. For a second, it's fairly inept on every level. Third, its depiction of location is horribly stereotypical to the point of actually being offensive. And that's me really trying to not go off on one further than that. It really is bad. I think in terms of the actual football, it's not too bad, but there are these weird moments in it, you know, where the camera sort of, when it goes to like an individual shot more often than not, where it just suddenly appears so false. And there are, like, the best footballer in this film by a long, long way is young Jimmy right at the start. You know where he's playing in the playground?
Yeah.
That is a kid.
The guy who I'm pretty sure they actually like cloned Sean Bean.
Oh, I know.
Grew him up to the age of 15 or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, it genuinely looks like you bastard Sean Bean. But I mean, that kid can play football properly. You know, Sean Bean is not a bad footballer, but he's never better than average. And some of his goals in particular, we've talked before, actually, Seven, you made that excellent point. I think it was during the Damn United about how it's difficult to fake the goalkeeper. You know, you can sort of do elements of everything else, but a goalkeeper even attempting to save a shot that he knows he's got to miss just doesn't look right.
As Bruce Grubbelaar found out.
Yeah. And as Pat Jennings found out when he was dressed as an oil filter in another one of my favourite adverts. But I don't know. It really is just bad, this film.
I know what you mean. I think on that, and we might as well talk about that side of it now, I think it intentionally, it does a lot of cutting in, as you say, kind of too close shots.
Yeah.
And I think it does that deliberately because I think there is an awareness there of the limitations of trying to film football action. And I mean, Mike Bassett, England manager, only comes along a few years after this and manages to do wide shots because they actually, you know, they almost entirely cast footballers and they choreograph them, and you get shots like, there's a great wide shot of Tonka actually dribbling through a defence that looks to me fairly legitimate. It's still, you know, it's not 100%. It's, you know, the only way you're ever going to get 100% is to do a dream team and to actually CGI the kits onto real action. But it's fairly well done. This film doesn't really attempt to do that, and I think I generally don't have a problem with it until it becomes glaring towards the end. And I think the biggest issue is that you never see a full frame shot of him scoring the penalty at the end. It has to cut in such a way that you never see the path of the ball into the net. No. And that's really jarring, and that creates a jarring effect in your brain because your brain doesn't have the closure of actually watching the moment. And if your brain is attuned to watching football, you're like, well, where's that moment gone?
Yeah.
But in general, when it's just doing the kind of the cut and thrust of a match, I actually think it's quite, it plays quite wisely in terms of keeping things close in. And I didn't generally get a sense of this looks really fake. I think quite key in the kind of, you know, when he's playing for Sheffield United, I think the atmosphere is strong. Again, this is probably where I'll give the film the most credit. The noise and the kind of the light, the kind of the floodlit feel and the mud and the sound and everything, I think it's got good atmosphere in those sequences.
I don't want to disagree with you, but I get elements of what you're saying. There are so many things that take me out of the action constantly. Firstly, every other actor on both sides, apart from, you've got Mel Sterland, who's playing Sheffield United's captain. I don't think he ever gets named in it.
He's just referred to as captain. Although I think, and from looking at, there is an image of the team sheet on some blog or other. Is it like Cavalcade of Shirts or something like that?
Sounds awful.
Circus of Kits, yeah. I think. Circusofkits.com. And he is, what it does is it lists the two teams. It's for the Arsenal one, actually. It's not for the, it's for the one where he doesn't, one of the ones where he doesn't play. And the names are all people who worked at Sheffield United, apparently, except Mel Sterland is called Mel. In the film, in the credits, he's just referred to as captain. But on that Sheffield United team sheet, he is Mel Sterland, captain. So, right. So in this film's universe, the legendary Sheffield Wednesday player, Mel Sterland, who played, what, like hundreds of games for Sheffield Wednesday?
Yeah, and Leeds.
Was Sheffield United's captain.
Yeah.
Which is bizarre. Why?
This is what I'm talking about. There's so many bits that take me out of the action. That's a big one. The second one is that this was filmed on the night of that relatively infamous Man United, Sheffield United FA Cup replay. I think it was the night of the Cantona chip.
Mm-hmm.
And right, so one of my biggest problems here is nobody looks like a footballer, Seb. Some of them.
Oh, there's a great when they're in that cup tie when they're all running out.
They all look about 40.
And it's like I could kind of understand it for Sheffield United, but the fictional Man United players all look like 40-year-old pub players. This is 1995, 96 era Man United.
Yeah,
this is like the slick at this point, the slickest footballing machine that this country had ever seen.
Yeah, this is what I mean. None of them look like footballers. There's a couple of them who've genuinely got like beer bellies. And you like the referee runs out and he's about 70. So that's another one. And it's like there's that moment where he plays the 1-2 with Mel Sterland, except you clearly see the ball being played by Mel Sterland from like, I think sort of just inside his own half. And then he nods it back to Mel Sterland, who has basically run about 30 yards in about, well, probably certainly less than 4 seconds. And it's just stuff like that where it's like, oh, God. Some of the amateur stuff is not too bad. And I don't know how it was filmed, but for instance, I've talked about it on the Mike Bassett one, but Mean Machine is a film I have like a sneaking amount of I actually quite like that film, Seb. But what they did with the football at the end is they obviously had moments that they had to create and they had to make. But they played over a week. They played like, I think they played like 4 90-minute games and just filmed them all so that you know that all the incidental stuff was proper football. But they also managed to get a couple of people scoring goals that were genuine. And it does make a difference. Here, I don't think that's happened at all. It feels to me like nearly everything is choreographed and it just doesn't work for me. You know, like Sean Bean has had this hard life working at the brewery.
Mm-hmm.
He's a drinker. I think when he made this film, I think he was about 33. And the first logic jump we have to make, Seb, is that Sheffield United go, oh, yeah, let's give him a trial, right? So that's the first massive logic jump. The second is the detail. So as I said, nobody looks like a footballer. FA Cup semi-final not being played at a neutral venue, being played at Sheffield United's home ground. It's these little things where you realise this has been, instead of being made by somebody who wanted to make a football film, this is being made by somebody who was told to make a football film. That's my honest reaction to it.
I get what you mean. And this whole thing about it being, you know, not at a neutral venue because they used a third round tie and all of that. I'm minded to be slightly more sympathetic to the film than you are, and indeed a lot of other people are, because as I say, this does get picked up on quite a lot in relation to this film. It seems to be one of the biggest niggles that people have with it. The way I kind of view that sort of thing is that this is taking place in a fictional universe where, for example, Mel Sterland is the Sheffield United captain, not the Sheffield Wednesday captain. I can sort of forgive some of the rules being slightly different. I would prefer it if they were as close as possible. But like how in Mike Bassett, England manager, the England team play in the wrong shade of kind of almost black, blue, and don't have the England badge on their shirts. They just have the word England and an Admiral logo because that's that universe, you know. I get that it's an issue, but I think the way I actually view it kind of from the opposite perspective to you, which is that I actually look at understanding the filmmaking circumstances, which are the sequence of events effectively goes, he needs to have a moment in a really big match. That big match kind of needs to be at the end of the season. It can't really be the FA Cup third round because the timeline of the film is such that it has to come late in the season. It has to come after a certain amount of time has passed. They have footage available of a very recent Sheffield United team playing against Manchester United, who are recognisable. It makes sense. And what they don't have is footage of, like, if he was playing for Man United in the film, they could use footage of Man United in an FA Cup semi-final because they'd been in one recently. Sheffield United had not been in an FA Cup semi-final recently.
Yeah, I just...
Although, then again, now I've said that, so that to me, what I'm basically saying is that I can sort of see that the circumstances mean that they can use this footage, which obviously isn't at a neutral venue, and they can... just fudge it. Actually, there is a way around it, because I'm just looking at the screenshot that's on it's actually on Dennis's blog, of the teams running out, and they are running out in front of a big Sheffield United FC board. It would actually have been quite easy to not have that in shot, and while anyone who knew what Bramall Lane looked like would know the footage was at Bramall Lane, the film could tell you that it wasn't at Bramall Lane. And as long as you've covered up enough identifying stuff, you know what I mean?
It's yeah,
like, it doesn't matter that the ground looks like Bramall Lane. If you're just saying it's a ground, it doesn't have to be the same one that you shot at. So actually, there was a way around it. So maybe it is just a bit lazy.
this is the problem. It, like, on Adam's piece, Football and Film, it's a set piece where he talks about when Saturday comes, and he does manage to talk about it in a semi-affectionate way, which I just can't. If you do, we'll link to that article, I think, when we put this piece out. If you go down, you will see that there's a photo of a Man United player elbowing Sean Bean, right? That Man United player tells you everything you need to know in terms of the authenticity of because yeah, genuinely, he looks like the middle manager at a small pharmacy. You know, he's overweight, he's balding, he's never seen a footballer in his life. And these are the things that, like, I struggle to forgive it for, because I think the thing is, like, Mike Bassett was made on even less of a budget than this. I mean, Neva had a decent budget, but on even less of a budget. And they managed via trickery and just being clever to capture a lot more authenticity. I think Jimmy Grimble, which is a film I have a lot of affection for that we will get to one day, was made for, you know, I think it was made for about a tenner all in. And you know, is capturing kids' football, and it's basically Billy's Boots, the movie, but still manages to capture things far more authentically than here. It's just, there are things here that I just think are unforgivable, and I just can't remove my brain enough. Like, we talked about Driven, Seb, and the thing about that film, as two people who like motorsport, both of us can sit down and watch that film, and you almost lean into the silliness of it. I just can't do that with this film. I can't.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
What you talk about with the kind of the authenticity and the difference with Mike Bassett, I think it's interesting at this point to kind of look at the production circumstances of it.
Yeah.
Because I think some of the detail around who made this and why they made it, I think does shed some light on some things about it. So it's written and produced, sorry, so it's, well, co-written by a husband and wife team, James Daly and Maria. We were struggling with the pronunciation. I think, did we settle on Geiser?
I think it's Geis.
Okay, Geis. Let's say well Maria Geis.
Yeah.
They were a husband and wife team. James Daly at that point had been working his way, according to the production notes for the film, had worked his way up from waiter to co-producer on such Hollywood hits as Highlander 2 and 3. Now, actually, according to IMDb, now IMDb can be wrong, but he's only actually credited as producer on Highlander 3. His only two producer credits, according to IMDb, of this film and Highlander 3. I first looked into this because when I watched this, I was surprised to see Christopher Lambert's name on the film as a producer.
Yeah.
So James Daly is from Sheffield, but at the time of this film in 1996, had spent 14 years in LA. So he'd done the classic Brit thing of going over to LA, working away, beavering away, trying to get a career as a writer producer, and eventually did in the case of this film. And it's directed by his wife Maria Geis, who's American. And evidently, he must have befriended Christopher Lambert while producing the dreadful third Highlander film. And Christopher Lambert gets involved with this as a producer and you know, kind of helped in terms of, again, according to production notes, helped in terms of raising the money for the film. So, but what is quite interesting is that, again, according to the production notes and other material I've read around the film, James Daly basically based the film on his own story. So he said, you know, so he was a promising footballer with Hallam. He was given a trial for United. He said, I had a trial at Sheffield United, but screwed it up. I got drunk the night before and woke up next to a stripper. So he has literally worked his own life story into this film, but he's given it a different resolution, which is that it works out for Sean Bean. So on the one hand, it's quite surprising that the film seemingly lacks this authenticity and also, I think, this kind of thematic art because it's based on something that really happened to him. On the other hand, as I say, these production notes mention that he'd spent 14 years in LA. So if you work backwards, this trial with Sheffield United can't have been any later than the early to mid-1980s. And I think that's why you've got, even though it's a guy from Sheffield who's obviously been in and around football when he was younger, has then spent the last 14 years in Hollywood, I think that's why his grasp on mid-1990s English Premier League football is maybe lacking a little bit. And I think that's why the film feels so throwback, is that it's based on events possibly up to 20 years previously.
This is the problem, Seb, right? That if me or you had been paid 200 quid by the people making this film merely just to act as a fact checker, you would improve this film like tenfold, genuinely. And those circumstances make an awful lot of sense, because you're right, this film does feel like someone harking back to a time long before. I mean,
well,
this film, like, it feels out of date in 1996, never mind
2019.
You know, it's
the thing is that you say that about, you know, sort of someone checking the football stuff would have improved it from a football point of view. I don't deny that that's the case. I think the key thing is, and this is, you can sometimes get accused of this when you're talking about films in terms of assuming motivations. All right, so take all this with a pinch of salt, because this is my inference based on having watched the film. I don't think the filmmakers particularly care about that. And the reason I don't think they care about that is that because the question that I was asking myself when I was watching this film was, who is it actually aimed at? because I don't think this film is aimed at football fans in the way that, again, you Mike Bassett or even, you know, your Jimmy Grimble or that kind of thing is aimed at people who love football and want to see a film. You know, Mike Bassett is so rooted in being about football. I don't think, while I think it's a much better film than this, I don't think The Damned United is necessarily aimed at football fans. I think The Damned United is a character drama that happens to be about football. But actually, you could take Michael Sheen and Timothy Spall playing very similar characters and have that film be about something completely different from football. I think you could still have the same arc and you could have the same stuff go on and people would still like it. You couldn't do that with Mike Bassett. I think you could do that with this, because I think this film, what this film is actually, is a grim romance melodrama that happens to have football being the thing that the character does. But it could be anything that Sean Bean's character has as a potential career. He could be trying to be a rock star, and the film could have almost exactly the same arc. And I think the film, even though it is its original conception is James Daly wanting to write something about when he was nearly a footballer, I think by the time you get to the final film, you've got something that is actually about this bloke from Sheffield, this tough-talking guy, and the relationship that he has with this terribly accented Irish girl, and how his life kind of goes off the rails, but then he tries to get it back. And that's why I don't think they seem to particularly care about getting the football right, because even though it's called When Saturday Comes, and even though it's purportedly a football film, that to me is the key, is that I don't think that it's really about the football.
I wouldn't disagree with that, but the marketing and everything and the trailer is all about it being a football film.
Genuinely, I think that is because of when it comes out. And I think the fact that it happened to come out in 1996 is a fortuitous coincidence in terms of this film and its reputation and the fact that people remember it. Because, you know, when they're making this film, they've got no idea that Euro 96 is going to play out the way that it does.
It was released in March as well, wasn't it? So it's 3 months before Euro 96 goes.
But it's in the build-up, and the point is that at around about the point when, for example, this would have been coming out on video, Euro 96 has happened. And I think it accidentally happens to be the football film that comes out the year. And I do, you know, I'd say even pre-Euro 96, the build-up was going on and the country was becoming more obsessed with football. It comes out the year that England becomes obsessed with football, and so it becomes the zeitgeisty football film that people latch onto. I think that is entirely accidental, and I kind of suspect that's one of the only reasons why people even remember it now. I think more people saw this because of the nation being swept up in a football zeitgeist than they would have done if it had come out in 1993.
Yeah, I mean, again, I wouldn't disagree, but I'm still struggling to forgive it. Anything. Its original title was A Pint of Bitter, and I think we can establish that would have been a far better title for it, in truth.
Well, it would have meant that Andy Lyons and co would not have had to spend the last 23 years going, no, not the film, not the Sean Bean. We're not anything to do with Sean Bean. No, we were around for 11 years before this came along.
I want to get into one or two specifics. And the first question I'm going to ask, and I ask semi in jest, but also out of absolute bafflement, I'm going to run through some of the people in the cast in a minute, Seb, but why in this film is everyone doing an accent, including your bastard Sean Bean? Everybody is doing an accent. It is bizarre. And I mean, you've just mentioned Emily Lloyd's Irish accent, which is not good, but apparently apparently she was switched to an Irish accent because her northern accent was even worse.
I think if you reach a point where you've cast somebody in a film where they've got to play somebody from the north and they can't do the accent, the first question is, well, why do you persist in having the, but then the idea to switch to an accent and go, yes, that's better. If that Irish accent is better than whatever she was trying to do for a Sheffield accent, yeah. God only knows what it sounded like.
So I want to run through one or two members of this cast, because like on reflection, this is a decent cast, Seb. So we've already talked about your bastard Sean Bean. There's Emily Lloyd, Pete Postlethwaite, who is, you know, generally speaking, is just great in anything
I mean,
he does.
Yeah, he's just doing his... I mean, he's Pete Postlethwaite. The dials aren't turned up very high. He's never having to get particularly out of, like, second gear. But he's just doing his Pete Postlethwaite thing. You know, this isn't Brassed Off in terms of, like, you know, that speech that he has in Brassed Off, like, is your sort of your big Pete Postlethwaite moment. It's not that, but it's you're always going to get a base level of quality with him, and he delivers that. Yeah.
Craig Kelly as Jimmy's brother Russell.
Kelly, Vince from Queer as Folk.
Yes, who's
looking very young in this film.
Yeah, but like a couple of things here really. So his death is choreographed basically from the opening 5 minutes. I mean, anybody who even watched this at the time and didn't realise that was coming, I mean, I really do pity you. And so his accent, obviously, Craig Kelly is an accent. He's an actor from Manchester, and has got quite a... He's got a very recognisable voice now, Seb, due to he's done voiceovers on various adverts and various other things. Very, very good actor. Doesn't appear in loads and loads of stuff, but usually he's got a very good radar, because what he appears in is usually quality. In this, he's got a half Sheffield, half Manchester accent that
it's
just
really
lurches
affected,
from one to the
it?
Other in the course of a sentence. And he's the Sheffield United fan of the piece, isn't he? He is the sort of the obsessive. And of course, Jimmy needs a motivation to sort himself out. So he has to die down to pit. And it's just like his character and his whole arc, I think, is one of the most on the nose things about this film. Am I wrong there? Or
no, I know what you mean. It's like, yeah, every development, and then all the whole thing about the dad, yeah, kind of selling the program, and oh, that whole bit with the horse bet, and
this is what I mean about it being a fairly hateful film, because I don't know that if, how can I put this? Because I don't want to say anything offensive, but I don't know if he's trying to play the brother as slightly mentally handicapped as well. Because sometimes it comes across almost as though he's supposed to be, well, I'll put it politely, but incredibly slow. But the problem is the character is so poorly defined that I don't know if that's actually a thing. I don't know if that's something that was written in. I don't know if it's something Craig Kelly is doing off his own back. And it just like creates this sort of complete lack of authenticity that when he comes on screen, it just takes me straight out the film. It's just another aspect of this film I can't stand on reflection.
Just before we move away from Craig Kelly very quickly, are you aware of his connection to something we have previously covered on this podcast?
Is he a voice in the Billy the Fish cartoon?
No, there's only one voice in the Billy the Fish cartoon.
Yeah, Harry Enfield.
No, he's Tonka's brother.
Oh, yes.
Craig Kelly is brother of Dean Lennox Kelly.
Yes, yeah. Of course he is. Dean Lennox Kelly, who is another actor I think is pretty good, who doesn't turn up in enough things for me, to be honest. You've also got a sprinkling of other sort of talent in this film. So John Henshaw turns up as he's manager of... Is he Hallam's manager? Let me get this right. Yes, he's Hallam's manager. You've got Melanie Hill in there.
Oh yes, and can we let's just talk about the thing that we were talking about this off mic before this discussion, which I've discovered.
Sherlock Sepp here has discovered a connection.
So at the time that this film was made, Melanie Hill was married to Sean Bean, although they were only about a year or so away from divorcing. This film stars Sean Bean alongside his wife, who plays his sister in this, which, you know, a bit weird, but whatever. Meanwhile, it's written, co-written and produced and directed by a husband and wife team who later split up. And Melanie Hill is now married to James Daly, the writer and co-producer of this film. They had stayed friends after making this film and then eventually got together and are now a couple. So that's what he's been up to since then, is, you know, with his sparse IMDb credits. He's obviously been working somewhere, but I thought that was quite sweet and a little bit weird, but quite sweet.
And then you've got we've mentioned Mel Sterland as captain. Tony Curry plays himself, obviously Sheffield United legend. That's another.
I can't remember if Tony Curry actually says a word at any point. He does a lot of standing around watching and nodding and agreeing with people, but it's I can't remember if he actually speaks.
Yeah, he does. He talks to Pete Postlethwaite, who I can't remember the name of Pete Postlethwaite's character, which shows you how well developed his
Ken
character
Jackson.
Was. Yeah. But yeah, he does speak to him briefly at one point. So there is a sprinkling of talent in this film, but like half of them seem to be in one film, half of them seem to be in another. They're all doing an accent. You said it right at the start when I asked for your sort of overview. Some of these really good actors are delivering absolutely woeful performances. And I'll be honest, Seb, I'm going to put it out there, including your bastard, Sean Bean. I think he's terrible in this film. Absolutely terrible. The only time he's sort of semi-convincing is when he's in the working men's club, when he's in the pub, and he's got a drink in his hand. And he feels any time he's not, he just comes across as a complete fish out of water, regardless of what the circumstances are.
Well, the thing about this is that he's... Okay, I'm going to try and admittedly, I might miss out some bits or get some bits slightly out of sequence, because we had some scheduling issues with getting this recorded. It's actually been a few weeks since I watched this, and it's so bad, I didn't want to go back and watch it a second time before we recorded.
No, never again.
But right, I want to just chart his character's arc through this film. Right, okay. So he starts out, we meet him as a kid at school, and he's your classic sort of, you know, he's a bit kind of like tearaway, loutish sort of, you know, but he obviously loves to play football, and he's a bit cheeky, and the teachers and his dad tell him he's never going to get anywhere. His dad's an absolute thundering arsehole,
a gambling addict
who we discover is bitter and jealous because he himself had failed to become a footballer, and he thinks his son would be good for nothing. So then we meet him as an adult, and I do believe that it was, I'm going to read the description again from Dennis, who was sadly unable to join us for this, from his blog, where he describes Jimmy as somebody who works in a Sheffield brewery, and at the weekend he helps to ensure that its products are consumed. Never mind the weekend, I think it's every evening as well. So he's working in a factory, working in a brewery. The foreman hates him. He's cheeky. He's a jack the lad, basically. He's got this younger brother who's obsessed with Sheffield United and collecting football programs, and he may be a little bit slow. His dad and his brother work down the mines, but he works in this brewery. He plays football. He gets spotted playing football, and he immediately makes the step up to go and play for Sheffield Hallam. So we see him playing football, but we don't really sort of get a sort of a sense of this dream to become a footballer. It's just he likes playing football. He starts to play for Sheffield Hallam, where he falls out with your man from Dinner Ladies and The Full Monty. what's the actor's name? Steve Hewson. Steve Hewson, he falls out with him because he's their star player, but Sean Bean's better than him. Even at this point, though, we've had no sort of... There's no point where we're kind of invited to sympathise with him, really. He starts going out with the new wages clerk at the factory, who's Irish, but her uncle is from Sheffield and she lives in Sheffield, so I don't know where she's got this Irish accent from, but presumably she went over to Ireland and then came back with this bizarre accent. Then he gets the opportunity, he gets spotted again and get... Or is it that does the manager actually go to Sheffield United to say, I've got this prospect? And then anyway, he gets a trial at Sheffield United. He gets some trials, which through his own idiocy, he screws up the trials because he goes out and gets pissed and he shags a stripper. So he loses his girlfriend, but his girlfriend's pregnant. He nearly misses out on playing for Sheffield United, but he decides to get his arse into gear after his brother dies. So his brother dies. He gets his arse into gear. He signs for Sheffield United. He sits kicking his heels on the bench. He grumbles about being on the bench. All of a sudden, he, through injuries, he basically gets to play in this game against Man United. And he scores a penalty against Man United. I think to earn them a draw, is it? Or is it actually to win? Is it to earn them a draw? I'm pretty sure they're 2-0 down. And then he assists the first goal. And then he scores the penalty. So he don't even win the match. It's a 2-2 draw. Or do they get through? Anyway, either way, then it ends. And it's just, and I realise I've gone through that in like quite a rote way and be like, and then this, and then this, and then this. But the reason that I've done that is I never felt at any point in this film, and it comes back to what I was saying at the start about how you never root for anybody. It's not even that you never root for anybody. I don't even see, there's no character arc there. Nah. All there is this thing happens to him, and then this thing happens to him, and then this thing happens to him. And throughout all of it, his only defining personality traits are he's got a big gob on him, and he likes a drink.
Yeah.
And that's it.
And like, he grumbles like an arsehole at the slightest thing of, you know, anything going wrong, and he's just a miserable bastard.
Other than the fact that his brother dies, and okay, that is a pretty big but, I'll admit. But apart from that one big but, considering his circumstances in life, where he starts out, he ends up leading an incredibly charmed life, even down to the fact that he wins all this money on a bet placed out of spite. He flukily wins this horse racing bet placed out of spite. He basically walks into becoming a Premier League footballer.
Yep. It's mad.
You never get the sense that he deserves it.
No. Nope.
And you never get the sense that it's his dream. You never get the sense that he's reflected on what it would mean to become that. And apart from one training sequence where he chases Pete Postlethwaite's car up a hill, apart from that, you never get the sense that he works hard for it either. He just falls into it shown at the start that he's a talented footballer.
Yeah.
But that's it.
That's exactly what I was going to say. When his brother dies, him sorting himself out and trying to make an effort consists of him putting some beer cans in a bin bag and going for a jog.
Yeah.
That's it. The film doesn't even bother to really lean into that either.
I'm going to compare just purely to compare with stuff that we have specifically discussed on this podcast. Damned United, there are lots of points in that where, you know, where Brian Clough is being an arsehole, basically. And the arc of Damn United is Brian Clough, through his own ego, puts himself in a situation where he alienates everybody. He falls out with his best friend because he's being an arsehole. And then he realises that he's been being an arsehole and he makes up with his best friend who he loves. And there is an arc there. And that arc includes times when you're sympathetic towards him because he's getting dumped on and it's a shitty situation, and times where you know that he's bringing things on himself. And, you know, I'm not saying that, like, somebody has to be likable for the entirety of a film, but just show us the journey, show us the arc.
Yeah.
And this film just doesn't do that. It's just, and then he gets this, and then he gets this, and then he gets this, and oh, look, now he's scoring against Man United in the cup final. And I don't understand how that's supposed to be a triumphant moment. I think everyone involved feels like it's a triumphant moment because what they're portraying on screen, the writer and the star are Sheffield United fans, and the writer and the star are making a film where a guy from Sheffield gets to play for Sheffield United and scores the winner against Man United in the cup semi-final. So to them, that's But that would be like me writing a film where the climactic part of the storyline was, and then Liverpool win the Champions League. That's all well and good if you happen to like them, but where are the narrative stakes if you don't give a shit about that particular football team?
Yeah.
Because you haven't given, the film hasn't given us any reason to care about them. And again, to make another comparison, Mike Bassett has made us care about whether or not Mike succeeds, and it's given us enough of the characters and the different personalities in the team. We want to see Tonka come good. We want to see Rufus Smalls actually score a goal, you know, all of that stuff. It's given us enough of those bits that we feel invested in that group of players and the result that they get. And we don't get that with this team that basically consists of Sean Bean and Mel Sterland. With that scene with the goal, which again Dennis pointed out, where Sterland starts the move by lamping it upfield. It's flicked on by Sean Bean, and then having raced at the speed of light into the penalty area, he scores it.
Yeah, that's what I was on about. These are the things where the criminal thing about this film, the thing I can't forgive it for, is there is a genuine lack of care taken with it, with stuff like that, that any editor in the world should have been, in the course of putting this together, should have been having a word with the director and saying, we may need to have a look at this. It's just so lazy, which it brings me onto something I want to talk about, and I'm gonna keep it fairly succinct, because I could go over the top here, but the depiction of Sheffield in this film as generic rundown northern town is bordering on offensive at times. So, you know, everybody's working down to pit still, and I mean all the mines in Sheffield are closed. I think there was one left about 3 or 4 years before this film opened. That was the very last one to close. Everything seems run down. Everything is grotty. Everything is working class with a capital W and a capital C. Sheffield, I can tell you from living up here for a long, long time now, Sheffield has been and was, before this film was produced, it's a very progressive city. It genuinely is. And I mean, if you go to Sheffield now and go into the city centre, you'll see it's a great city. It is so lazily depicted in this film, and so generically depicted in this film. It really is a fairly offensive level of stereotyping. Now, I know why they've done it, and that's because they think it enhances Jimmy's story as this guy from, you know, again, working class with a capital W and a capital C background in a working class town, and scoring that goal is the thing that will bring the town together, Seb, you know, and everybody will be behind it. But it just doesn't work. It just does not work. And the thing I would contrast it with is, if you look at The Full Monty, which is a film also set in Sheffield, also about being working class, also depicts the city in, at times, a very sort of dark and grim and gritty light, showing, you know, shows the steelworks shut down, etc. But still also manages to capture the fact that Sheffield is a city that is progressive, and that is not just terrace houses and working men's clubs, and walks that line really, really well. Shows that it can be done, but just nobody's interested in that in this film. All anybody's interested in this film is graffiti on the walls, red brick terraces, an estate that looks like it could have been the Chatsworth from Shameless. You know, it's that sort of really lazy stereotype. And again, it's another one of those things that I just can't forgive this film for. I just can't. And as I said, I don't think I'll ever use the word hateful in regard to something we're reviewing again, but that for me is genuinely one of the most hateful aspects of this film. It never, ever, ever bothers to cast any sort of positive light over its location apart from when it's on the football pitch at the end. And it doesn't earn that. It doesn't earn that retribution. It really doesn't. It's like you said and explained really, really well, Seb. This film is just a collection of things that happened to a man. That's all it is. There's nothing deeper there. There's no punch the air moment. You know, a sport. The great sports films are about an arc that at some point in the film leaves you punching the air, whether it's the damn United, Rocky, you know, it doesn't matter what it is. There's always that moment. Mm. And you're right, this film, it doesn't earn it. So when they put that moment on the screen, it's like, yeah. And?
Mm. And it's so frustrating because it's not hard to see a film about... Because, yeah, it's all the stuff you said about Sheffield, and it's like the film basically presents where he lives as the reason why everything's shit.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's because that's what he's been born into. What it doesn't do is go beyond that to go, yes, but what are the external factors and the reasons why that is, and what are the socio-political reasons why that's the case? And I'm not saying the film has to get massively socio-political, but I'm just saying it has to say there is a reason why people feel this way, why the prospects are poor at this particular time and this, that and the other. It's not just because it's Sheffield, it's because it's Sheffield in this particular place, in this particular time, because these things have been closed, because this has happened, because this government's done this. And what a sports film set in that environment should do, and that's why it's so easy to see the film that does this, is that it makes football be the thing that brings people kind of hope and then inspires them in their lives outside of that, and helps them to kind of work against the external factors that are causing life to be shit. And, you know, again, if the film had just planted, other than the fact that at the start he has this thing of, oh, I'm really good at football, I really want to be a footballer, it's like the film doesn't even go, well, if I can, at least if I become a footballer, I can escape my abusive father and the lack of prospects and this, that and the other. It doesn't even draw a line for that. And so, yeah, as you say, that moment at the end, which we're supposed to feel, obviously the film thinks that we feel this triumphant punch the air moment. We don't, because then it's just like, oh, okay, well, he's done that. Now what?
Yeah, what's next?
He'll probably just look into the England team next. You know, the England manager will happen to have been watching that game and he'll get an England cap at the age of 36.
Yeah, you know? And somehow he'll manage to stuff it up by going out and getting drunk again, but then he'll realise... get himself together and get another chance.
Mm.
Like, it's just...
I mean, to be fair, that happens in Mike Bassett with Tonka, but...
It does, but I mean, that's...
But we love that character.
Yeah, so. And it's also... It's a completely different context. What this film is repeatedly saying is, you can keep blowing it and you'll still get chances. And it's like... It's not... The best sports films are about people who've had one opportunity... So they have, you know, they've grasped it with both hands. At some point, we will cover Goal, and we'll probably do the whole trilogy. But the first film in particular is not a bad film at all. It's a very watchable film. And it never once leans into crappy cliches about Newcastle, you know, and the city and all that sort of thing. And... it's all the better for it. And I...
Well, it's... I would not expect bad stereotypes about Newcastle from Clement and Lefrenet.
No, you know? No, but this is the thing about this film, is it's... This isn't what Sheffield was like in 1996. Maybe if the film, as you say, had been set when the writer was going through this himself in potentially... 1976, maybe, but it's just, it feels, it was dated then, and I mean now it's just horrendous. So we've been punching this film for about an hour now, non-stop. find me one redeemable quality, because I'm struggling, Seb.
Well, to be fair, while you didn't, I did say at the start that I think generally the match action is good. I think if Dennis were here, and again, Dennis has kind of picked apart the kit related stuff. Dennis's biggest problem with the kits, and it's a valid one, is that the numbers on shirts generally look wrong. I would say my favourite thing about the film is that early on in the film, it features one of the best goalkeeper shirts ever, which is the 91 Umbro shirt with the triangles on it. Now, it's not in the blue version, because the kind of the turquoisey blue version is the best one, but it's a purple version that, particularly with the blonde hair of the keeper in the scene, makes me think of Chris Woods. So the presence of a couple of good... And actually, in a later scene, you get the next year's Umbro purple goalie shirt, but it's the, you know, when they went retro and the goalie shirts all were big ones with pinstripes, and it's the purple one with the pink pinstripes, which makes me think of Ipswich, actually, that stripy template. But there you go. In Dennis's absence, I've done the kit chat, but you get some nice kits in this film. And as I say, I would come back to, I think apart from that opening park scene, all of the matches, I think, are mostly set at night, and I think that's to the film's benefit, because you get lots of night shots of floodlights reflecting off the mud, and I think that gives a nice, atmospheric feel to it. I think it feels nitty gritty of football at times, and it's just a shame that it doesn't capture that more throughout the film, and that it doesn't tie that to a good story and remotely likable characters and any good dialogue whatsoever.
Yeah. You just reminded me of something else, though, Seb, that really annoyed me. This is the problem with this film. I cannot think of this film without being annoyed. I moaned earlier about that Man United team coming out looking like every team of over 40s you've ever played at six-a-side in your life. But then when it comes to take that penalty, I'm not joking you. I mean, people who go back and revisit this film will see what I mean. Everybody on that football pitch looks 40 to 45, right? Genuinely. Apart from Man United's keeper, who genuinely looks about 13. If you go back and watch it, honestly, he looks like, you know, he looks like a teenager. So I don't know where is the consistency? How can you put like a team of balding blokes with beer bellies on as Man United with a 13-year-old in goal? It is just so sloppy. I'll go on record, Seb, I can't think of a single redeemable quality. The only thing I like about this film is the fact that I never, ever have to watch it again, ever. And I won't. I genuinely won't, because watching it again for this podcast, it wound me up like you wouldn't believe. It's just 90 minutes of hate watching for me, and I've just got too much going on in my life to ever consider doing that again. If you're listening to this and you have a great deal of affection for it, absolutely fair enough. I'm not going to tell you what to like. But I would say, if you haven't watched it in the last 10 years, maybe try another little run through and then get back to me and see if you still...
Oh, I don't know. I would say, if you have fond memories of it, don't ruin them by rewatching.
Yeah, true.
Cling on to your positive memories of it.
Yeah, you're right, actually. You're absolutely right, yeah. Never. Do what I'm going to do and never, ever, ever watch it again. So, when Saturday comes, in short, shite.
That's a cheery way to end.
We've done in this podcast, I think we've been quite lucky, because even Billy the Fish, which we both went back and did, and I wouldn't say either of us particularly enjoyed, but there's still moments where it is actually genuinely pretty good. There are still jokes that land. It's not actively a chore. This film is actively a chore. Within 2 minutes of watching it, you are literally looking at the clock going, how long is left?
I think what frustrates me the most about it is that the 90s are obviously such a you know, I mean, obviously to us because they're the era that we grew up, but in general, in terms of football in this country, the 90s are such a pivotal decade. I think more pivotal than any decade that's come since, in terms of the growth of football and of football culture. And in almost every other area, in the 90s, you've got a range of football books, you've got an awful lot of football on TV, TV about football, fiction, documentaries, all the rest of it. You've got a great range of football games, which we're going to come and cover at some point. Films, other than Fever Pitch, which kind of doesn't really count anyway, the 90s are lacking in football films that are basically that act as a time capsule of that era. This is kind of the main one. This is the big 90s football film. And it represents the era so poorly. You know, we've got Goal and Mike Bassett for the 2000s. And for all the problems with Goal, I think Goal comes out working quite well as a time capsule of the 2000s. Like, I think you can watch Goal and get a sense of where football was in the mid-2000s, you know? This film does not do that for 90s football. And given everything that was going on in 90s football, I feel like we've lost out by having this as the representative of that decade in this medium.
Yeah, I... It just doesn't work, this film, and it's a shame that it has the sort of level of prominence, because literally anything else deserves it, and this really doesn't. Anyway, we have beat up this film severely. Right, we have a couple of things to report. The first is we are now on Instagram, aren't we, Seb?
Yes.
Beyond the Touchline Pod. All three of us are posting on there. We've had Gazza the Game and I took a picture of my bookshelves, and we had a little sneak peek of the Roy the Rovers celebration annual, which you have written copious amounts for, Seb, and is definitely, I think anybody who's listening to this podcast, if they haven't picked that up, they really should pretty quickly.
It's a shame you've probably missed the Black Friday sale where the hardback was half price.
Yeah, yeah.
Still get it at the Roy the Rovers website.
But we're also on Twitter and in all the usual places. Please leave us a review if you are enjoying it. We are going to get back onto a much more regular schedule next year. We've been slightly hit and miss because we've had everything from new arrivals to illnesses to computer troubles to everything has just got in our way, basically. But eventually we have got to this point, and we in the new year we're all committed to getting on a much more regular schedule, and we've got some very good stuff lined up. And finally I'm going to convince the other two to watch Jimmy Brimble. So in short, never watch when Saturday comes. It's goodbye from me, David Hartrick. See you later.
And goodbye from me, Seb Patrick. I will also see you later, I suppose.
Bye.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.